Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. Today we're going to start the show a little bit by talking about mulch with Erin Presley. She's the herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Gardens in Madison. She also manages the wildflower and pond gardens there. Great interest in vegetables as well, so we can talk with her about a lot of things. We'll start with mulch, but she can pretty much answer any gardening question you might have. So I hope you'll join in the conversation. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can send us an email to ideas@WPR.org. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. Erin Presley, welcome back. Good to have you with us again.
Hi, Larry. I miss being in your studio with you, but I got the best seat in the house here at Olbrich today.
Oh, I bet you do. And I'm sorry not to be seeing you in person as well, but talk about Olbrich Garden. What's it look like there?
It is, as many of you can imagine who are enjoying your own home gardens, a little bit extra this year with some maybe some more free time on your hands. The garden is looking gorgeous. We're just finishing up with some of our late season bulbs. So we have a lot of blue and white camassia that are coming into bloom, some of the very, very late daffodils, nice tree peonies that are in full glory right now, and we'll have our herbaceous peonies coming into bloom in the next week or so. And then, of course, the beginning of the real powerhouse perennials that'll be blooming for the beginning of June that form kind of exactly what I'm going to talk about today, sort of the underlying matrix of our gardens here, the real workhorse plants that come up, cover the ground early, establish a green ground cover, and now we're getting to enjoy their flowers. We've got the first of the alliums, some catmint going out there. Veronica's will be on the way shortly. It's really, really lovely. And fortunately, our staff has always been considered part of an essential workforce. So the horticulture staff has been employed here full time throughout this crisis, and we're really hustling to get it looking good for everybody.
How can people help out the gardens during this difficult time?
We're very fortunate that we were able to kind of save our spring plant sale. So we went to an online format for our plant sale and with curbside pickup, and we're able to bring in some revenue that way. Funds are pretty tight. You know, we have our normal city backing and the support of the Olbrich Botanical Society, but our normal fundraisers and events and everything we'd be doing right now to get people in the door and get some, you know, cash flow going here, a lot of that is really on hold. So we've been doing, actually just this morning, I was making some bouquets for our flash flower sale, and weekly through Facebook and Instagram, we're offering floral bouquets from the garden. So those are available for people to pick up. Today there were some nice scented geraniums that we sold off, and that's all done with a contact-free pickup. So I keep an eye out for those. Of course, donations are always helpful, but it's just also been really nice to have just the support of all the people that can't wait to get back here and enjoy the gardens and find the respite that we're really ready to provide here. So just your well wishes means a heck of a lot to us, too.
Yeah, for sure. We can talk some more about that as we go along today. But let's get back to mulch for a minute. Gardeners love mulch, I think, for the most part. I certainly do, because it has a lot of advantages.
Yeah, we all know, you know, good gardeners always know that what you really want to avoid in your garden is having large amounts of open soil. You know, that's where you got to get a lot of weeds moving in to colonize. Easy to lose water really rapidly from those areas. So we're always looking for ways to just cover and secure the soil. And people do that in all different ways, and there's really a mulch for every occasion. A lot of people are fans of the double shredded hardwood bark mulch. Here at Olbrich, we do leaf mulch, which is a kind of like a composted chopped leaf product that we make ourselves from the leaves that are collected off of the city streets. And we can go into more detail about how that's possible on a home scale. But really, our ultimate goal is to create what we call a living mulch. And so that means that whatever garden space you have, you can find the right plant that is going to be able to fill any little niche in space or an ecological niche and really take advantage of all of the little microhabitats that are available in your garden and really start to develop pretty much a complete green ground cover of ground cover plants, perennials, that is acting as your mulch and providing the same benefits. And the bonus of all of this is it is preventing you from having to haul all of those heavy wheelbarrows in the spring. I'm sure many folks out there right now, especially with the recent rain, those weeds are getting big and you're looking for something to cover up the soil and mitigate that in the future.
Well, when you go to the garden center, you see all different kinds of mulches, and I know you're familiar with the various barks and so forth, wood mulches. What are the pros and cons of each type of mulch?
Yeah, so at its most basic level, what we try to do here is always retain the organic matter on your property. So whatever you have that you can chop up and compost a little bit and just put back onto your garden beds to form a mulch is really, in my mind, the best alternative because it's saving on gas, saving on labor of hauling materials back and forth. So what we do here in the early spring is we mow most of our perennials down and especially grasses and leave that kind of dander, that fluffy organic material on top of the soil, and that's what forms the beginning of your mulch. Then from there, you can move on to, like, we use the leaf compost. So that's basically leaves that you would pick up off your yard in the fall and stockpile and then chop up a little bit with your lawnmower and reapply. Otherwise, I think a good bet that's still available to most homeowners and people are very familiar with is the double shredded hardwood bark mulch. That we here, since we are trying to develop that living ground cover, we only use that in some very, very small areas. But if you're just getting started with a perennial garden, that's still a good option. Just try not to be too heavy-handed with the hardwood bark mulch. Usually, a 2-inch or so layer should be enough to accomplish your goals.
Yeah, there's a lot there. Kathy in Madison has a question relating to mulch. Let's go there. Hi, Kathy.
Hi there. I've got some garden area, but I've had blight in my soil, and I left it go for 5 years, and I got it back again anyway. I'm trying to get something on the ground underneath the tomato plants and around them to kind of keep the dirt from splashing back up onto the plant.
Yeah.
Do you have any recommendations?
I think that is a great opportunity to use some of those. Do you have any leaves on your property that maybe didn't quite get used up in the fall?
No.
That would be probably my first choice because it's nice and light. You're going to want to avoid bark mulch around there because as the carbon disintegrates in that mulch, it can kind of tie up other nutrients in the soil. Another nice option, straw is also always really great in a veggie garden. So if you can go even to, a local garden center and pick up a bale of straw, they're more likely to have stuff that is free of weed seeds. And that is an excellent, excellent mulch for any open areas in your veggie garden.
All right, so Kathy, good.
Straw route.
Thank you, Kathy, for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in, too, at 800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Kita emailed to ask, how can one make sure mulch is weed-free? Can wood chips be solarized to kill any weed seeds? Does that destroy the biotic value of mulch?
Wow, these are some heavy-hitting questions here. Solarizing your wood chips. I cannot speak to that from any scientific standpoint. I would say that the solarization probably kills off any biological activity that would be positive too. So you're probably going to start with a somewhat sterile medium. It might take a little bit longer for the wood chips to break down in that case because they haven't been able to kind of get started on their activation process through that solarization. So I cannot really speak to that. On the other hand, usually the wood chips that you're getting from like a city source, those are from trees that were probably relatively healthy, like just street trees that needed to come down, that in all likelihood don't have a lot of lingering disease problems in them already. But that would be a good thing to maybe check up with your local extension agency and see if they have further information on the solarization process, because that's one that I'm not familiar with.
Yeah. Thanks very much for that question. Appreciate it. What are the mistakes that gardeners make when it comes to mulch?
Oh, there are so many mistakes. you know, we know that mulching is a good thing. You know, we can all sense that we don't want a lot of open soil. We need something to keep the weeds down. We need something to just protect the soil from erosion with some of the heavy rains that we get. One of the things that is, you know, kind of dismaying to see is when you get a really thick layer of that hardwood bark or wood chips around perennials, because it does really inhibit growth right at their crown, especially if it's kind of smushed up right against there. Anytime you're applying mulch, you want to give a good inch or two away from either the crown of your perennials so they have room to breathe and expand. And especially, we all know about the mulch volcano. So this is where you have a nice tree in your landscape, but then people have a tendency to pile a lot of mulch right up against the trunk, which is a really great way to promote insect activity right at the root flare, which you really don't want. So whenever you're mulching, you know, give your plants a little bit of space to grow. That would be probably my number one thing that I notice a lot of, is just being really heavy-handed with the mulch, especially wood chips or something like that. 2 inches is a good amount. Here at Olbrich with the leaf mulch, you can go a little thicker because it does break down quickly, like 3 to 4 inches. But just try not to be too heavy-handed with it.
Andy in Mount Horeb, we'll give you a chance now. Hi, Andy.
Hi. I'm an amateur wood turner, and I probably crank out about a 55-gallon drum of wood shavings every week or so. And I separate shavings by species. The walnut is really great for keeping weeds down, and the cherry and the box elder are great for gardens. So that's a place where someone might find some additional mulch if they'd like it.
Oh, there you go. Comment on that, Aaron?
You're really going the extra mile there by separating by species, and you have your own like little custom blends there. I like that idea.
I think so. Thanks, Andy. Appreciate the call. Richard in Two Rivers, your turn. Hi, Richard.
Yeah, thanks for having me on the air. Hey, Larry, the salmon are biting in Two Rivers, man.
Oh. Good
hey,
to know.
I got a question regarding my garden. I wanted to wait until the night temperature got a little warmer, which it has, or at least it's predicted to. And I put down that black type of paper that stops weeds from coming up. I wanted to know, should you put mulch on top of that? Or I have it in the past, but could I?
So are you talking, you have like the woven landscape fabric?
Correct.
It would be kind of gray and sort of like a mixture of like a paper and fabric. Go ahead.
It's just black. It's just that black stuff. It stops all weeds from coming up, and I put a perforated hose underneath it so it gets water when I want to water it.
Oh, okay. I would say that probably one thing you might want to watch out for there is early in the season, that black is really helpful in warming up the soil, like right now. But I would think that later in the summer, a little bit of a layer of mulch over that to keep the heat down might be beneficial. As a weed barrier, it's, I'm sure, effective either way. And, larger scale farmers grow lots of crops just right on top of black plastic or black row cover like you have. So you wouldn't necessarily need it, but might help keep it a little bit cooler later if we get some really hot summer days in July and August, but not a necessity, I don't think.
There you go, Richard. Thank you so much for calling. Visiting today with Aaron Presley, the herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison. I'm Larry Mueller. Jill Nadeau, our producer, Tyler Ditter, our engineer, and you, my friends, are listening to the Ideas Network. Thanks for listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here with my guest Aaron Presley from the Olbrich Botanical Gardens in Madison, talking about mulch, but a lot of other gardening questions coming in as well. Really appreciate them. You can email us right now at ideas@wpr.org. Phone lines are filled right now, so let's go back to the phones and take a call from Gary in Ripon. Gary, hello. Thank you for calling.
Yeah, good morning. This is not a mulch question, but I live in western Fond du Lac County. I have 7 crabapple trees, and this year only one of them got any blossoms on to any extent. Is that something that's happened, or is it just me?
No, I'm guessing that's related to the weather, but Aaron, what do you think?
Yeah, I do think that could be weather-related. At least in Madison, we have gotten a really hard freeze maybe, about 2.5 weeks ago. I think it got down to 24 here, which is, very unseasonable. So that definitely could have, kind of zapped your blossoms. And the other thing is, especially a lot of older varieties of apples and crab apples do have a tendency to do alternate year flowering. So just naturally, by way of their genetics, they would have one year where they had a really floriferous season, and then the next year they might need kind of a rest, and you wouldn't see as many blooms in those off years. So easily could have been the hard frost as well, though.
All right. There you go, Gary. Thank you for calling. Chuck in West Salem, your turn. Hi. Thanks for calling.
Hello. Thank you for taking my call. I have a shady area that is overtaken by about every invasive you can think about. Autumn olive, honeysuckle, buckthorn, and Japanese privet. And I'd like to restore this area, and I'm cutting most of those invasives way back to the roots, to the soil level, and putting down cardboard, and then putting on top of that about 4 inches of wood chips. I have pretty much an endless supply of wood chips, like one of the other callers previously. Am I likely to be successful in keeping them down with that kind of strategy?
I hate to tell you that you probably are not going to be able to get on top of the sort of woody, persistent woody invasive species that you're battling there with that methodology. The kind of that lasagna gardening method where you do cardboard and wood chips typically would work well on something with a shallower root. Like that works great on turf if you're trying to kill off grass to create a new garden bed, or even, smaller weed infestations. But when you get into the woody material, like the buckthorn and honeysuckle, that really is going to require an application of some sort of herbicide, right? When you're making those cuts, that's really the only way, unless you want to get into doing a lot of hand digging, which is always an option and the preferred option for any sort of weed removal. But what you typically would do if you're removing those woody invasives is as you're cutting them down to, a 3 or 4 inch level, you're immediately treating the cut stumps with an herbicide that's meant for brush. And I think just normal glyphosate, like Roundup, is labeled for that. You definitely have to pay attention.
Oh, I think we lost Aaron. Aaron, are you there? No, she isn't. Aaron Presley, our guest. I bet Jill Nadeau is feverishly working right now to get her back online. Aaron, of course, the herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Gardens. And I think her advice to Chuck is good. Those woody plants are going to come through. And if you've already laid that information or that material down, I guess the thing to do would be to wait. And when some of that woody stuff comes back up, that you do as Aaron suggested, and go ahead and go get in there and cut it back, and then apply apply an herbicide that is designed to kill woody plants. And that way, if you've already done all the work, Chuck, you're going to be able to sort of take care of that part of it. So there you go. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. You can join in too, 800-642-1234. Aaron Presley back with us. Aaron, sorry we lost you there. Good to have you back.
I'm glad to be back.
All right, there we go. We've taken care of Chuck. Let's go to Jeff in Madison. Jeff, hello.
Good afternoon. Good morning.
Good morning.
We love composted leaf mulch. It's been marvelous on our flower gardens. It's fantastic stuff. But I wonder how Olbrich handles jumping worms. It's always
Big question. So as you all know, many places throughout Madison have some pretty serious infestations of jumping worms, and they are starting to make inroads in our garden as well. I think that's kind of an inevitability for a lot of people's gardens if you're really bringing any sort of plant material in and out at all. So one thing that is really important is if you're doing any sort of plant swap or plant trade with your friends, or even when you are planting new plants from the garden center, try to remove as much of the potting soil as you feel that you can to inhibit the risk of carrying along jumping worms or cocoons. Plant material you get from the garden center is not going to be an issue, but if you have plants that you're getting from anybody else's yard, that's a good first step to keep them away. We definitely are just doing good cultural practices to take care of our plants. So we do the leaf compost to help retain moisture in the soil, because you know the jumping worms do kind of create that grainy, really fast-draining soil, and it's hard to hold water in those soils. So that's where mulch comes in and helps. We have also somewhat of a supply of the early bird fertilizer, which is a product that kills jumping worms and other worms in a natural fashion. It has a derivative of tea tree oil in it that brings them up to the surface, and then they just kind of dry out. So we do have somewhat of a supply of that, but to my understanding, that product is actually no longer being produced. So this goes back again to just trying to find plants that are going to be able to survive in the conditions with the jumping worms. And one thing that we're finding is a really great ground cover for a variety of garden situations and can tolerate them is one of the first sedges that was popularized in garden usage, and that's Carex pennsylvanica, pen sedge. And in some of our areas where the jumping worms have been more active, that's one plant that's still totally unaffected. So the main thing, I think, is just don't get discouraged and try to keep planting and, just find out what plants you're going to have, they're going to be able to tolerate that pressure from the jumping worms.
Yeah. Could you mention the name of the sedge again?
Yes, it is Penn sedge, Pennsylvania sedge. So it's Carex pennsylvanica, and it's a small grassy plant, but it is adapted to both sun or shade and also very drought tolerant. So it gets to be about 8 or 9 inches tall, and it spreads via a runner. So not aggressively, though, not in a problematic way, but it can kind of move in and creep in amongst your other perennials and cover the ground. And it does seem also to tolerate the jumping worms really well. And right now it's a beautiful, grassy, flowing, bright kind of apple green color. Great ground cover for shade or sun, and something the jumping worms are not bugging yet. So there's a lot of things out there. I think we're going to find what works and what doesn't work with the jumping worms. And another thing I think that's really helpful is when we get into the hotter parts of the summer, we're very attentive to watering. So I think we've been lucky the past couple of years in Madison. a lot of the jumping pressure, worm pressure has been masked because we've had really heavy rains throughout the summer. But I think if we get into some more drought-like conditions in the next, you know, this summer or after, it's going to be more important to apply a little bit more water to mitigate that draining effect of the jumping worms.
Hmm. There we go. Thank you very much for that question. Chet in Athens, it's your turn. Hi, Chet.
Hello.
Hi, what's on your mind today?
Yes, well, I planted potatoes after preparing my soil a couple weeks ago, and I put the potato seeds on top of the ground, and then I mulched it. And I'm wondering whether I need to pull the mulch away and cover it with dirt, because I didn't cover any of the seeds with dirt, but I covered it with at least 6 inches or more of old hay. And if you could tell me, I should maybe pull that mulch back because I don't see much sprouting, or is it too early? Is it a couple weeks?
I would think that you could give it a little bit of time yet before you see those potato sprouts, especially since you're up there in Athens where it's a little bit colder. And I, as far as I know, a lot of people have really great success growing potatoes in lighter materials like that, like straw or more of a mulch material than just regular garden soil, because the potatoes then are really easy to harvest in that light material later. So just like so many other good garden questions, I would say wait and see.
yeah,
one thing that you could try, though, is in just a little area, I would dig down and see if you can locate some of your seed potatoes and just see if there's, you know, make sure that there are some sprouts coming up. But if they're at all sprouted, they'll be able to find their way through your straw or whatever you have on top of them.
Yeah, I was thinking, you know, I've used the straw bales for straw bale gardening from the previous year. I just break them up, put them in a big pile, and then just throw the seed potatoes right in there, kind of cover them up. And I've had pretty good luck with that practice. So, and it's a whole lot easier to harvest the potatoes too. I might tell you that. So I think you're okay there, Chet. Thanks for calling. Linda in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Linda.
Hi, thank you. Well, I have two questions and one comment. One question is about hostas. Is there a disease going around right now here in Madison? I'm not sure if dogs are peeing on them because it's right by the sidewalk, or if there's just some disease. And then I was wondering about for wood chips, how... at Madison Block and Stone, they have playground wood chips, which are apparently softwood. And I'm just wondering how those would work for using that and how fast they decay compared to, like, the bark mulch. And then my comment is about the woman that called in about, you know, her tomatoes getting the disease because it's in the ground. And I had that problem, too. And I put straw down, but I found that since squirrels would always be trying to dig up holes to put their black walnuts there.
Oh, in the straw? Yeah.
Yeah, so I had to put down some, like, hardware wire, like half-inch hardware wire or chicken wire or something down first, and then put the mulch over it, and that would prevent the squirrels from digging soil on top of the straw mulch.
Sure.
I had to give it up anyway because of the black walnuts. It just couldn't grow tomatoes. But anyway, if you have that problem of squirrels keep digging holes because they just dig dirt right on top of the straw. Yeah.
All right. Okay. Thank you. All right. Lots of things to talk about there, Erin.
Right. So the first question about the hostas, I guess to really diagnose what you might have going on there without a visual or a little more description, I can't say much. It's possible also along the sidewalk, you might be seeing a little bit of like latent salt damage from the winter if there was salting that was done. But that would be a good one to maybe hop on the UW Extension website and look at their hosta fact sheets and find exactly what cultural issue you're battling there and kind of go from there. As far as the playground wood chips versus the hardwood bark mulch? Again, without actually seeing it, I'm not quite sure. I'm thinking when I hear of the playground wood chips, I think of more of a larger kind of blocky wood chip that would be distributed in a playground. And that could make a decent mulch for, you know, a larger planting bed or more so around woody specimens. I think that would have a hard time breaking down amongst perennials like you'd like it to and becoming a part of the soil. It might be there for quite a while without really breaking down, which could be a good thing. But on the other hand, sometimes those really blocky mulches actually still have a lot of space between the pieces for weeds to germinate up through them anyway. So without really seeing it, I can't 100% accurately answer that question, but try it in a little area of your garden and see how it works for you, I guess, is the best way to start.
Yeah, that makes good sense. Linda, thank you for calling. Well, Tom, in Partyville, it's your turn. Hi, Tom.
Hi, good morning. So I'm calling about, we moved into a house a couple of years ago that somebody had planted a wisteria.
Oh, yeah.
They planted it along the foundation of the deck, but it has migrated over to the house as well. And we've had a wisteria plant before. We're not the biggest fans. So
Okay. Anyway,
my question is, what would you suggest would be the best way to try and get rid of this? I know we've cut it back a couple of times, but boy, it just keeps it seems to re-energize itself. So
yeah, actually, the one thing that is, you know, I would consider a selling point of the wisteria is it does, as far as the flowering is concerned, wisteria benefits from cutting back really, really hard. So even if you left kind of one of the main stems of the wisteria, like the main trunk, and cut a lot of its whippy branches back super hard in the spring, you could maintain that plant and still enjoy the flowers without feeling like it's taking over the whole rest of your landscape. Otherwise, to actually get rid of it, you know, any sort of woody material like that, you're looking at some pretty good time with a shovel. So cut it back to the ground and get your shovel out and dig out all of the roots. No amount of cutting it back from the top is ever going to really eradicate it if what you really want to do is be done with it entirely. So I would say, though, feel free to weed prune our wisteria here on one of the first days, nice days in late March. And we cut back all of the real long whippy shoots to two buds. So it would be about like little 8-inch sections. And then from there, new growth sprouts and the flowers. And then after it flowers, feel free to whack it back again over the summer too.
All right, there you go. Thank you, Tom, for calling. Appreciate it. Let's turn to Christy in Chippewa Falls. Hi, Christy.
Hi, thanks for a great show, and I'm really excited to be using no-till in my vegetable garden for the first time this year. Just a reminder, apparently was mentioned previously on Garden Talk that a non-chemical way to deal with buckthorn invasives is the buckthorn baggie developed by an engineering student, and I guess the concept is to, by blocking the sun, at cutting time, you put this black baggie over it and can kill it. And then when you use an herbicide, it's effective in the fall as the roots draw down, but the baggie would work all times of the year. Thanks.
All right. Thanks very much for calling. Have you heard about that, Erin?
I have heard of it, and I have never personally used it, but what a great development. So I can't, you know, speak to the effectivity, but I definitely think it's worth, especially if you're looking at a smaller scale invasion or a particularly nasty one, to experiment with that if it seems cost-effective or realistic.
Yeah, it makes sense. Thanks, Christy. Appreciate the call. Buckthorn baggies. Let's go to Mike in Minocqua. Hi, Mike.
Hi, Larry. How you doing? Hi, everybody. My question is yeah, I usually mulch around my trees and around perennials. with cedar mulch or cypress mulch, what do you do with it the following year? Should you remove it all, or just mulch over it, or how do you get rid of it, or do you need to even get rid of it in the spring?
I think the most, the most beautiful thing about any of the mulches, the organic mulches that we're talking about, is regardless of the rate of their breakdown, they're all over time enriching your soil and turning into good organic matter. So with the cedar chips, is a little bit more rot resistant, and those will probably provide good coverage and control of weeds for a little bit longer than your average bark mulch. But then when it does need to be refreshed, go ahead and just sprinkle a little bit more right on top. There's no need to rake out or remove the old mulch in any way. That's all just breaking down into nice garden soil in your beds.
Yeah, there you go, Mike. Thank you very much. And a whole lot less work, too, than digging it all back out again. Roy in Whitewater, it's your turn. Hi, Roy.
Hi, Larry. I have another suggestion on how to get rid of buckthorn and honeysuckle. I've been there, done that with the cut the stump and treat it with glyphosate. If you have a skid loader like I do, or you have a neighbor, maybe a farmer with a skid loader, you put your forks on the front of the skid loader and you get right beneath the base of either of those two plants. For the honeysuckle, you want it about 10 inches apart. And for the buckthorn, it's a broader rooted system, probably twice that, maybe 18 inches. And they pluck out just like that. It's actually kind of fun.
So have you, well, you probably haven't tried that, Aaron, at Olbrich.
I have not. Cannot say that I'm out there running the bobcat and getting rid of big buckthorns in the middle of everything. But the one thing that I would say about both buckthorn and honeysuckle is, you know what they say about an ounce of prevention. And it's amazing when you have wet soil like we have right now. Some of the larger buckthorns, you know, even the ones that are as thick around maybe as your thumb, they really pull pretty easily. So once you do get your big woody specimens or the ones that are dropping seeds under control, or if you're just having buckthorn moving into your area, you can really pull a lot of the little ones really fast, and that's going to save you so much work down the line. So physical removal, like with the forks from the potting shed or the forks on your skid steer bucket, is going to be your best bet when feasible.
Yeah, I like that idea, Roy. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, you can join in too. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Talking today with Aaron Presley, herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. I'm Larry Mueller. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. Thanks for joining us today on the Ideas Network. We're talking mulch with Aaron Presley, but we're taking all kinds of gardening questions. So I hope you'll join in with your questions as we move along through the show today. You can reach us at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. That's ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. And a caller from Antioch, I believe. Let's see. Let's go to our Wausau caller next. And I'm having a little trouble with my screen right now and not seeing the name of that person. So we'll try and get that fixed. But Wausau caller, what's your name?
Yeah, hi. My name is Boris. I have a question regarding pine mulch. We have a huge pile of some pines that were basically ground up by service. And I wonder, what can I and what should I not do with it?
Sure. Well, you're really sitting on a gold mine there if you've got a nice pile of wood chips. like I was saying before, some of the heavier bark-based or wood-based mulches, the one thing you have to kind of watch out for there is as they break down, since they have so much carbon in them, they can tend to pull a lot of other nutrients from the soil as they break down and make them somewhat unavailable to your other plants, especially things that have smaller root systems. So try not to use those chips around annual flowers or in your vegetable garden. Maybe paths in your vegetable garden are good for that, but not right around the plants. You could go use those around perennials, but just use a light touch and keep them away from the crown of the perennials. And then that sort of chippy mix that you would get from a tree service works really great on shrubs or trees. And you could also use that if you have a compost pile. It makes a nice brown ingredient to mix with other more green nitrogenous materials as you're getting the compost blend right in your compost pile. So lots of good uses for it. Or just leave it in a stack in your backyard and it'll be slowly breaking down and turning into, you know, a nice soil-like substance just on your own. It'll just take a while.
It just take a while, Boris. There you go. Jeff in Madison, it's your turn. Hi, Jeff.
Hello there. I'd like to revisit the topic about composted leaf mulch. And yeah. My original question was, how does Old Brick control for jumping worms within the leaf mulch? I think the original answer had to do more with how to handle plants as you're getting them from garden centers. I'm more concerned about the composted leaf mulch itself and the jumping worms.
Okay. So for us, go ahead.
Yeah, I think he was just saying thank you.
Oh, okay. For us here, we can't really be choosy because we need leaves in such huge quantities that it comes from all over the city. And so there is a possibility that the leaves that we're picking up do have the cocoons or the actual live worms in them. So here, we don't have a lot of control over that. And on the other hand, though, I have not seen, even later in the summer, after the mulch has been sitting around for a while, we don't see a lot of jumping worms in it. So that's a good sign. On your own property, the best thing that you can do, and this is going to become more and more important over time as people do realize kind of the benefits of keeping their own material within their garden, is just save everything that is getting clipped up or cut up in your garden. The best mulch that you're going to be able to make is from your own material. So, or if you have neighbors that you know have yards that are free of the jumping worms, see if you can collect their leaves if they're not using them. On a large scale, I think anybody who is producing leaf mulch, I know a few places such as Schoenheit Gardens, I believe, at least a year or two ago, was looking into a composting system, so they would raise the temperature in their leaf mulch high enough that it would kill the jumping worm cocoons. But there's so much that we don't know about the jumping worms. I am unable to speak, you know, in a real certain fashion about whose techniques are working and whose are not. But the moral of the story is, the more you can just keep your own organic material on your own property and use that as much as you can, that's going to be your best bet.
You know, early bird fertilizer?
Right.
It's too bad they're not making that.
Yeah, because we had seen some pretty, I've heard people having various degrees of control using it, but we definitely did have luck with using that to knock down some pretty severe populations, at least at certain times. I'm sure there's still cocoons there. And as long as I think the jumping worms are something we're all just going to have to kind of get used to and experiment in our own gardens to find what's going to work and what's not. There's not going to be a bulletproof answer for keeping them out or killing them once you have them.
Yeah, that's the problem. Killing them once you have them is not, there's nothing out there that I know of anyway that will do it. So there you go, Jeff. Thank you. Connie in Antioch has a question. Let's go there. Hi, Connie.
Hello. Thank you. I am really, really interested in this green mulch idea that you spoke about earlier, and I'd like to hear more about it and what might be recommended for me. I have a southern exposure. It's a mixed border of a crabapple and some pine trees and some perennial grasses. What would be a good green ground cover to go under that?
Sure. I'm going to, right off of the bat here, I'm going to point you towards a great book. I actually have it in front of me right now for a little inspiration, and it is written by a Wisconsin plantsman, Roy Diblick, who's out of Lake Geneva, and he has done a lot of large-scale plantings that use this premise, and the name of the book is The No Maintenance Perennial Garden, and it's K-N-O-W, maintenance. So his whole thing is that if you find plants that are covering the soil and adding ecosystem services and work together in combination with your other plants in a good way, you can start to eliminate a lot of this mulching, and your plants start to behave more in a fashion similar to like a natural ecosystem versus just being individual plants that are, you know, buried in a sea of mulch and don't really have any relationship to each other. So one of the key components of that is you establish a lot of early season emerging perennials that are coming up. They sprout early, and they're the type of thing that are starting to bloom, you know, almost now. So here at and the other thing that's great about Roy's book is he chooses plants that are very forgiving. So if you kind of start with some of the things on his list, you're going to glom on to something that clicks for you pretty well first, right off the bat. So here we typically use in a sun to part shade area a lot of ornamental alliums. And so these are not like the bulbing allium that you are used to seeing right now. They're more of a ground cover with a grassy foliage, and they do get a nice flower later on, kind of similar to a chive. A really popular one is Allium Summer Beauty. There's Millennium Allium. A lot of these plants are becoming more and more available at garden centers because they're winning awards from the Perennial Plant Association for how durable and useful they are. We use a lot of ornamental grasses, small-scale grasses. So a great one that's very adaptable is Prairie Dropseed. That's Spirobolus heterolepis. And it's a grass that tops out about a little bit under 2 feet, and then later in the summer it gets these beautiful, wavy, very fragrant seed heads. We have scads of that all over the place, so that's Prairie Dropseed. We use some geraniums are good candidates for that. A really nice one that can kind of creep in amongst your other plants without running them over is some of the Biocovo geraniums. So they have a very like fibrous root system that runs at the soil level. There's Biocovo and Carmina geranium are good candidates. The list really goes on and on. Am I getting close to what you're looking at here? I would say if you're interested in this topic, pick up Roy's book, and you will be like so overwhelmed with ideas right off the bat. And a lot of these plants, due to their durability and versatility, are becoming a lot more popular in garden centers throughout the state, I think.
Yeah, and Roy's name is, his last name is spelled D-I-B-L-I-K, if I'm not mistaken. And the book, again, is The No, and No is spelled K-N-O-W, as Aaron was saying, The No Maintenance Perennial Garden. And it's quite a book. He's quite a guy.
Great guy. A true champion of getting people excited about gardening and making gardening accessible to everyone.
Yeah, he's kind of specializes in perennial gardens. He's a perennial garden designer, if I'm not mistaken.
Yeah, he has work all over. He's done a lot of upscale jobs in Chicago, like the Lurie Garden at Millennium Park. So very well respected, and his techniques have really revolutionized, I think, a lot of the way people look at their plantings and the way they treat and work with their plants as well.
Yeah. So, Connie, does that help out?
It's fabulous. Thank you, thank you, thank you. I think it sounds marvelous. I can't wait. Thank you so much. Take care.
You're very welcome. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Just a reminder, too, celebrate Women in Horticulture Week is June 1st through the 5th, so we can celebrate all of the women there who are involved in horticulture. And we can talk about that some more with at some other point. Erin Presley, our guest today. Erin, the herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Botanical Gardens. She also manages the wildflower and pond gardens at Olbrich. I'm Larry Mueller, and with Erin Presley, thank you for listening here on the Ideas Network. To have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller with my guest Erin Presley back with us, the herb garden horticulturist at Olbrich Gardens in Madison. She also manages the wildflower and the pond gardens there. So it's great to have her back. And certainly I hope you'll join in with your questions and comments as we move along today. Our lines are all filled right now. And we got a few emails to deal with as well. So the email address is ideas@wpr.org. The phone number, 800-642-1234. Erin, I don't know if you had a chance to see the photo that Jill sent to you from Susan wanting you to ID a plant. Have you been able to pull that up?
Yeah, with the little yellow bloom, and it looked like it had kind of glossy leaves there. Yeah,
yeah.
She lost her greenhouse tag, and how many of us have done that? Or just thought, I'm going to throw this away. I know I'll remember what this is next year. Just does not work that way. I am pretty sure that is a golden shrimp plant. So that's Pachystachys lutea, which is a pretty common houseplant, not hardy in our area, but a great long blooming houseplant.
So there we go. Joyce in Port Washington has a question. Let's go to Joyce. Hi, Joyce.
Hi, my question pertains to ferns. I wanted some ground cover, and my friend gave me some but warned me that they would march all over and claim ownership.
Sure.
And I would now like to reestablish myself as the owner, and I cannot dig them up. I don't have the strength. I can't pull them. They seem to be too strong. How can I get rid of those little devils?
I would really recommend, if you can, try to give them another go, because I'm sure that what you have is ostrich fern. And so they have, but the beauty of them is that you can really see where they, you know, around this time of year, they're probably fully emerged where you are, but they have that really knobby central core that the fronds unfurl from. And then if you follow those back, there's some really long, ropey stems that connect them to the other plants in their clump. And so if you can get underneath the big knobs, you can really be sure that you're getting out the whole plant. And sometimes for jobs like that, it's easier to use like a spading fork than a shovel, because the fork will let you kind of get around those ropey roots and lift up the plant without bringing so much soil along with it. The other thing that you might want to try is you might be able to tire those out pretty well by just repeatedly cutting them back. So every spring when the fronds came up, just cut them right back to the ground. If they start again, give them another cut back, and just keep kind of depleting them that way. would be another thing that you could try. Additionally, they are a fern, if they're ostrich fern, which is very likely, that's Matukia streviatris, which is a native fern too. They have edible fiddleheads. So early in the season, if you're going to be trying to attack them, you can pick the fiddleheads as they're unfurling and when they're still kind of tightly coiled at the top and cook them up like asparagus. They're actually really tasty.
All right. There we go, Joyce. Thank you very much for calling. Barbara emailed to ask if it was too late to plant ordinary kitchen herbs like chives, basil, dill, or parsley. If not, should it be done indoors in pots or outside in the ground?
Oh, no, this is a great time.
Perfect time.
Yeah, we are in full swing. We're, have nice moisture in the soil right now and some cool temperatures coming up after this, week of 80s that we had. So this is, plus we're getting pretty close to, I'm not sure where in Wisconsin she's calling from, but getting pretty well past the average last frost dates for most parts of Wisconsin. So the more tender herbs like basil that really don't like cool nights or cool temperatures are ready to go out along with everything else. Yeah, have at her.
Marilyn and Mequon on the line now. Let's go to Marilyn. Hi, thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have bags of mowed leaves from last fall. They're in clear plastic bags. I'd like to use the leaves as mulch in my perennial beds, but I have Canada thistle in the beds, and I've been digging the thistle so far. What do you recommend I do?
I would say that you probably are going to want to get to where you feel like you have a decent level of control of the thistle before you mulch. Otherwise, you're just going to be it's going to be impossible to keep your mulch on the top looking nice before you get the thistle under control. Canada thistle is a super noxious weed, and on a home scale, though, I have successfully been able to eradicate that by just repeatedly and very diligently, I guess, digging out those runners and tire them out. So you can go through an initial sweep. This time you see the thistles are up, try to dig them out, and then I'd maybe let them kind of whatever's left over come back and sprout again, get rid of those, and then think about putting your mulch down after that.
All right, there you go. Thank you, Marilyn, for calling. You can join in to 800-642-1234. Give a call. Mary in Plover, it's your turn. Hi, Mary.
Hi there, this is Mary. I have a ginormous mulch pile behind my garage, and my husband just turned it again. I actually planted pumpkins and squash on one side of it. But where we moved everything, it's a southern-facing area. I need a good ground cover there. It's got filtered sun, even though it's on the south side of a building.
Okay. Does it? So it typically gets, does it get kind of hot and dry there? So it's filtered, but it's kind of, when it does get hot, or when it does get sun, it gets kind of hot?
Yes, it does.
Yeah, okay. So there are, dry-ish shade is always the most dreaded of garden conditions, but there are definitely things that will work well for you there. One good option that I already mentioned was the Biocovo geranium. So those are very drought-tolerant. They have kind of a ropey stem that helps them withstand some tougher conditions. And then there's also geranium macrorhizum, big root geranium, which would work well in that situation. For something a little bit fancier, epimediums work really well. Those are very early blooming spring plants that like the shade, but they can also take dry. And if you want to get a few things where you can get a few from the garden center, plug them in and then let them kind of just reseed and do their stuff over there and not really have to worry about it anymore, I would suggest some of our native woodland asters. The first one that comes to mind is white wood aster. So that is Aster divaricatus. Recently had a name change, so it's Eurebia divaricatus, but white wood aster. And that is, if you're looking for something just cheap and easy that will colonize and fill that space for you and take those conditions, that would be an ideal candidate.
There you go, Mary. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. We have some other emails. Audrey emailed wondering at Olbrich's in the herb garden, there's something clay cloche, cloak?
Oh,
wondering
yeah.
What is under that? What is it and what's under it?
That's a funny question. So those are blanching pots, which especially in, I think, a lot of kind of European fine vegetable culture and fine cuisine, there would be a lot more field blanching of vegetables going on. So that would be done with rhubarb for one. So basically what happens is the rhubarb comes up in the spring. As it's emerging, you put one of those cloches over it. So for the listeners out there who are like, what is this thing? It's like a bell-shaped terracotta pot, and it has a hole in the top. So you would put this whole pot over the plant that you want to blanch, and it excludes the sunlight. So the vegetables, when they do kind of grow up through there and out the top, their stems are white and really tender. I think that's something that would be done with asparagus in some places. Cardoon is another vegetable that would be like field blanched in that way. But I typically use them just as decoration, or sometimes I use them to cover up things that are ugly. So like water spigots and stuff like that. We'll throw one of those over, and then you don't have to look at it and disrupt your viewing of the beautiful garden.
Okay. And she wonders, can you recommend a lavender for zone 4, and then any tips preparing it for winter?
Yeah, some of the best lavenders that are more cold hardy here in Wisconsin are, and they're readily available, are Hidcote, so that's H-I-D-C-O-T-E, and Munstead. And then another good one that has come out in the past couple of years that's a little bit more rangy and robust, it has a little bit more of like a wild habit, is Phenomenal. And we've had good hardiness of that. Lavender is one that benefits obviously from really sharp greening soil. So if you can mix in gravel or grit at the time of planting, that's good. Keep mulch away from the crown of the plants. You don't want a lot of organic material around the base of the plants at all, because they really need to breathe and drain. And then going into the winter, you don't need to do anything special aside from do not cut them back. Lavender is a plant that benefits from the winter protection of it having all of its foliage standing. And we're just getting around to cutting back our lavender here at Olbrich right now. So give it some time in the spring too.
Someone, in terms of mulch, somebody else had a question about a bed of daylilies that is mulch. Should you pull that mulch away from the daylily plants a little bit?
You know, with the daylilies, they're such sturdy characters. They're not going to really care if the mulch is right up against them or not, and they will be able to emerge through, you know, 6 inches of wood chips, if that's what you do on top of them. So I wouldn't waste your time, spend your time doing a little bit more fun garden tasks than pulling mulch away from the daylilies.
Teresa in Tomahawk, it's your turn. Hi, Teresa.
Hi. Hi, thanks for taking my call. I planted some coral bells last summer in my garden. They get about 6 hours of hot sun a day. I've had coral bells there before, but they don't appear to be coming back. Did I miss time when I planted them last year?
The one, I'm not sure exactly what coral bells you have, but coral bells are pretty notorious for not being exceptionally hardy. There are some exceptions to that, but if you don't know exactly what you're looking for in the coral bells, it's pretty likely that you would grab onto one that had like really great foliage color or other awesome attributes, but just is not that much of a performer. So I guess it's not surprising that they would not be coming back for you. I could, if you do really like the look of the coral bells, there are a few ones that we find to be really stellar performers here. There's an oldie but a goodie, Palace Purple, is very dependable in a wide variety of conditions. And then two that are more on the native end is there's Heuchera villosa, which is native to a little bit more south in the United States. And so if you are looking for coral bells,
look for ones that have Heuchera villosa in their parentage. There's a really nice one called Autumn Bride that is a little bit more sturdy. And then another nice native Heuchera coral bells that we use here is Heuchera richardsonii. And those are a little bit more robust and are likely to be better performers for you. So it's not surprising that you're not seeing them again this spring. When we do mapping here at the garden, because we map, you know, all of our garden areas, and one of the items that I frequently find myself, you know, deleting from the map because it died off in some area is various types of coral bells. So it probably wasn't just you. It just might have been not the greatest variety you happen to come across.
There you go. Thanks, Teresa. John in Evansville, your turn. Hi, John.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Big fan of the show.
Thank you.
Heard some information about using a single shred mulch instead of a double shred mulch in areas where you have jumping worm problems. The hypothesis is that the worms would feed less on a single shred or a thicker, chunkier mulch than what seems to be candy for them in the double shred mulch. Any experience or knowledge or any new information with regards to that?
Interesting. Thank you. Yeah, thanks for calling, John.
Yeah.
So, Aaron?
When it comes to jumping worms, there is a lot of conversation, like we're talking about, like the benefits of different types of mulch and whether the worms like or don't like or move more rapidly through different types of mulch. I think that what you're saying about the double versus the single shed, that totally makes sense. And if they are, working on decomposing that, it's going to take them longer to get through the more, the heavier pieces that are left in the single shed. In my own experience, I can't say that one is really that much better than the others. I did want to add, along with this jumping worm conversation, which seems like it's, comes up every time, but people are worried about the jumping worms. One garden soil amendment that we are working with here that, again, is just starting to have research relating to the jumping worms done on it is biochar. So that's basically like a charcoal-like substance that is finely ground, and it is very sharp to the jumping worms. And so it will actually deter them or possibly kill them just because it's so irritating to their skin. And then additionally, the biochar has a lot of other benefits as far as moisture retention and holding on to nutrients in the soil, which will also be helpful in mitigating the effects of the jumping worms. So I had heard in your sponsorship commercial, Brianna Frank from Treehouse Management is helping us to work here with one of our very favorite trees that was a real special tree retained during our construction project. It's a big swamp white oak right outside the window of the room I'm sitting in here. And so she is helping us ensure the longevity of that tree and kind of get through any shock it had experienced during our construction process with biochar applications. So we're really interested to see where that's going to take us and if that will help us with jumping worm problems in the future.
Oh, man. That's some good information, biochar, and that's available. You can get your hands on it. Right?
Yeah, I am not sure what I think in small quantities you could find out online where to order it from. Here we need bigger amounts, so we're getting it directly from Treehouse.
Ah, gotcha. And talking about a little more about mulches, Jake in Sister Bay emailed to suggest people buy wood mulch from local sources. He thinks the increase in ticks in Door County is from mulch brought in from other areas of the state. Can other insects and diseases come from mulch?
Yeah, I think what he talks about, the regionality of your mulch is very important. No matter where you're getting it from, it's really hard to verify its exact source and what may or may not be in there. But for the most part, using any kind of mulch is going to be better than using nothing. And if your gardens are already in decent shape and you're maintaining other proper cultural conditions, it's pretty unlikely that you're going to be bringing problems in with the mulch, unless you're talking about something, you know, really evident and really nasty like the jumping worms.
And Catherine in Madison emailed that she has tons of huge oak leaves every fall. She usually puts the leaves down on the street for the city, but it sounds like they better be used as mulch. How do you make the leaf mulch?
This is like exactly what we want to talk about. So have those leaves, stockpile them in the fall, just in some corner of your garden bed. Just stick them somewhere where they're kind of out of sight, out of mind. And then those are available for use in the spring. Pull them out onto just kind of an open area, and even on your lawn is fine, and make some rows that you can run over one or two times with your push mower. So, and then if your push mower has a bagger, you can either immediately use that material and distribute that on your garden beds, or you can just rake it up and then kind of throw it where your plants need it. Additionally, if you don't want to hold on to those leaves in a pile over the winter, just mow them up and stick them on right away in the fall, and then your mulching is kind of, you have a head start on your mulching for the following spring.
Yeah, Catherine, you should do that. I can remember driving over to my parents' home in the fall and bagging up all the leaves that they had and carrying it back to my house and then hanging on to it and using it. It was a great mulch for the vegetable garden that I had. And it really, it's a shame to be, you just put them out on the street, isn't it?
I mean, I think we should all really be thinking of the resources that our garden is already providing. And the more that we can do things like keep our own materials to ourselves and not haul things back and forth, that's where we are going to start turning the corner and not be transmitting things like the jumping worms that we don't want to bring in and out of our gardens. Your organic material is, you know, you work so hard to grow it during the growing season, all of your beautiful plants in your gardens, that stuff still has value, even though the year's growth is done. So there's very little that we haul out of this garden anymore when it comes to perennial clippings, definitely.
And I can read somebody else commented about lake weeds and wondering about them for a mulch. I used them in our when we had our lake home, and I used them all the time. And they're a little stinky sometimes, but they work just fine for a mulch. Well, Aaron, here we are out of time. I'm sorry we didn't get to all our calls and questions, but it's always a pleasure, and I hope you'll come back and be with us soon. Thank you for being with us.
Anytime. Thanks, Larry.
Erin Presley, the herb garden horticulturist at Obrick Gardens. She also manages the wildflower and pond gardens at Obrick. And we'll have her back again. That was a lot of fun. Next week on Garden Talk, Mark Dwyer will be back to talk about how to get kids interested in gardening, among other things. And so we're looking forward to that. Hope you have a great weekend. But you know what? Stay with us. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.